As in most of the occupied factories, the union-enforced cooperative has an egalitarian pay scale. Decisions are made by direct vote in regular assemblies, and each worker earns the same, based on the previous week's profits. Carroll estimates that workers have taken over 100 factories and other businesses nationwide. While most takeovers have been at factories, they have also included a supermarket, a medical clinic, a Patagonian mine, and a Buenos Aires shipyard. Often, the owners have struck a deal whereby the workers take over production in exchange for payment of rent or for giving back wages or benefits. Other factories are still in a state of legal limbo. But the ultimate aim for many worker-controlled factories is expropriation. In the past 2 years, 17 factories have been expropriated in the province of Buenos Aires, and in recent months, 3 in the capital. Provincial and city legislatures are drafting bills that would create a government agency to assist in the formation of cooperatives and facilitate the expropriation of bankrupt companies to hand them to the workers. However, dissent is brewing among influential economic interests. And as a result, political support for expropriations may be waning, said Beatriz Baltroc, a Buenos Aires city legislator who has been a leading proponent of the expropriations. While the first two expropriations in the capital were approved unanimously by the city legislature, the center-right Radical Party has since reversed its position, refusing to vote on the expropriation of Grisinopoli. The property of the owners is being ignored in order to transfer it to the employees. This is not an expropriation, it is a confiscation, said Gregorio Badeni, a constitutional lawyer. Expropriations can only be declared in cases of public benefit. In these cases, there is no public benefit. There is benefit for 20 or 30 people. But with local support for the factory-occupying workers strong, authorities have had little success removing them by force. In March, about 200 people from neighborhood assemblies and human rights groups converged on the worker-controlled Brookman Textile Factory, forcing the retreat of 70 riot police who were acting on a judge's order to reclaim the property. The idea that a capitalist is needed to organize production is being demystified, said Christian Castillo, a sociology professor at the University of Buenos Aires. If things improve economically, this movement perhaps may fade away. But the idea of worker control is out there. And that was Worker Control Breathes Life into Ailing Factories from the City Morning Herald of November 9th, written by Reed Lindsay. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests.
If you want to live in style, they say you've got to pack a little frog skin they call the greenback. will set you free. But burning crops in villages is really the key. Cayuga's cold and hungry, but I got my fill. Now I'm chilling with my mug on a dollar bill.
And that was Hank Roberts, the Wiggy Dog Boy, from his Truth and Reconciliation Show CD, that track called A Dollar Bill. Up next, Smithy with the Wizards of Money.
We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of a wiz, if ever a wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is the Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the Land of Oz. This is part 16 of the Wizards of Money series, and it is entitled, There's a Generic in My Shark Fin Soup. In this, the 16th edition of the Wizards of Money, we're going to take a look at the world of drugs, the legal ones, that is. The star of this episode is the only industry more profitable than the commercial banking sector throughout the 1990s, and that's the pharmaceutical industry. We'll start with a look at the recent wave of pharmaceutical mega-mergers and what's driving them, from the ominous shark fin curve to the elusive blockbuster drug to the need for ever more marketing shelf space. Then we'll look at the battles between the brand name drug companies and the generic companies, and the battles between the brand names and government and the other big giants of healthcare, the managed care companies. This journey through the shark-infested waters of legal drugs will give us a good look at the bizarre human behavior that results from allowing the capital markets and the patented medicine model to dominate decision-making in one of the oldest of human pursuits, that is, finding remedies for human illness. Allowing this behavior to continue unfettered may very well end in the capital markets giving themselves an incurable disease. 4. While the capital that flows into the pharmaceutical sector is obsessed with a couple of shark fins on the horizon, it is failing to notice the tidal wave swelling just over the horizon. This tidal wave is a global HIV/AIDS crisis, already striking at the very thing the capital markets need to survive. Far away in the land where shark fin soup is a high-priced legacy of imperial times, HIV/AIDS is rearing its ugly head. As the epidemic rips into China, will the US be able to continue its token level of support for this crisis of the developing world? Or will this threat to the labor force of a major trading partner provide the shock necessary to remind us that illness prevention and cure is, after all, a social service that does not fit well into the confines of 20-year patent monopolies? And will the exponential growth of HIV/AIDS in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet states, right on the doorstep of the European Union, wake up the rest of the West to the need to either act now or risk losing their global marketplace? Let's start our discussion about drugs with a discussion of what's been going on in the world of patented drug monopolies and the predator-prey dynamics in the drug sea. A July 16, 2002 article in The Economist announced the union of the two drug giants, Pfizer and Pharmacia, by opening, quote, depressed, bald-headed men with erectile dysfunction should be especially pleased, end quote. The companies that make the world's leading treatments for baldness, depression, and Mother Nature's way of telling gentlemen their reproductive years are over have combined to become the world's biggest legal drug giant. The Pfizer-Pharmacia combo boasts over $50 billion in annual drug sales and spends about $7 billion a year on drug R&D, short for research and development, plus another $3 to $4 billion on direct drug advertising. As in most industries, the capital markets drive the classic predator-prey dynamics of the pharmaceutical sector. You either eat or you get eaten. The Pfizer digestion of the smaller Pharmacia, announced in July 2002, was just the latest episode in the struggle to the top of the food chain. Let's go back to 1995, when much of the mega merger madness was just heating up. In that year, Glaxo Holdings gobbled up Wellcome PLC to form Glaxo Wellcome. The following year, the Swiss drug giant Novartis was formed out of the merger of Ciba Geigy and Sandoz. 1998 saw the creation of Aventis out of the fusion of smaller drug companies and also the creation of AstraZeneca from Astra and Zeneca. About a year later, Pharmacia and Upjohn thought Monsanto looked pretty tasty, mostly for their arthritis drug Celebrex, so they swallowed them whole, only to spit out the controversial agribusiness piece in August of this year. Also in 1999, we saw Pfizer swallow Warner Lambert. GlaxoSmithKline and SmithKline Beecham were fused together to form GlaxoSmithKline in the year 2000. And just when we thought the mergers couldn't get any bigger, Pfizer and Pharmacia announced their merger, pending regulatory approval, in July of 2002 to outsize GlaxoSmithKline and become the biggest fish in the drug sea. And just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, there are rumours of yet more drug predators out there and more drug mergers on the horizon. The modern pharmaceutical industry has its origins in the late 1800s when it became possible to mass produce compounds such as morphine and cocaine. By the early 20th century, drugs and compounds were patented by various companies to protect their discoveries. A patent on a branded drug or chemical gives the company a monopoly on sales of that chemical for a specified period, enabling them to set high prices in the absence of competition. The argument for patent protection is that it enables the developer to recover their investment in R&D plus a profit, hence providing incentive to private industry to find new cures. However, in order for the company to lure customers into buying such a high-priced product, they also need to spend a lot of money on advertising and marketing to convince people that it's a very special product. There are many arguments both for and against the patent model for pharmaceutical development, and we shall revisit these later. Today, the brand name drug companies look nothing like their chemical commodity predecessors of the 1800s. New products require large investments in R&D and take a long time to bring to market. The drug giants are dependent on patents, marketing, and branding to make a profit. Consequently, the pharmaceutical sector has more in common with the Hollywood movie industry than with any public service provider. This is because a new drug must become a profitable blockbuster or it is not worth the effort to develop it. In contrast to brand name companies, generic drug companies spend comparatively little on R&D and advertising, existing primarily to compete for market share based on price once a patent on a brand name drug has expired. Once such a patent has expired, generic companies can copy the drug and can afford to sell it at a lower price, as low as a quarter of the branded drug price, since they don't have as much R&D and advertising costs to recoup. After the roaring successes and record high profit levels seen throughout the 1990s, today we find that all is not well in the world of blockbuster remedies. Ailments in the branded pharmaceutical sector include looming patent expiries and the resulting competition from generic companies. Also, a drug R&D pipeline that is drying up, and angry governments, corporations, consumers, and managed care companies tired of high drug prices. These common enemies are forcing all these unions amongst the drug giants, who hope that consolidation will allow them to do more of their two favorite things at lower costs. And these two favorite things are 1, advertising, and 2, producing blockbusters. The future dangers to the general public of all this industry consolidation, in terms of even higher drug prices, and, more seriously, the lowered ability of the pharmaceutical sector to respond to real illness, are not getting much attention. The latter is reflected not only in the untreated epidemics haunting the developing world, but even here in the US, with increasing reports of shortages of basic medicines and vaccines at many hospitals. These problems are all compounded by the fact that drug companies are fighting dirtier and dirtier to counter what is known as the attack of the generics. A story in the Wall Street Journal in June of this year about the birth of the much touted heartburn drug Nexium gave many people their first good look at the importance of the shark fin curve haunting the pharmaceutical industry. You must know the Nexium ads, with a bunch of middle-aged folks standing around in some canyons that presumably represent something like an eroded esophagus, all mumbling, "I didn't know, I didn't know, I didn't know." Well, I bet they didn't know this. The only reason Nexium exists is that its predecessor, the original purple pill Prilosec, which is almost exactly the same, is coming off patent. It is sliding right down the other side of the shark fin curve. This eroded esophagus business is all about making the new patented drug Nexium seem different to the one that will now be copied by the generics.
I didn't know.
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 The Wall Street Journal article describes the shark fin curve as the sales versus time graph of a patented drug. Picture it as an upside-down letter V. As soon as a patented drug is launched, revenues generated by it shoot up over time like the rising edge of a shark fin. But the minute the drug comes off patent, revenues generated by that drug plunge just as quickly as they rose, as the generic companies come in, copy the drug, steal market share, and force prices to drop. We'll talk more about shark fins and eroded esophagi later when we look at some case studies of how the big drug companies fight back against generic competition. During the roaring 90s, the pharmaceutical industry always seemed to be topping the charts as the most profitable. We're all familiar with the blockbuster drugs who made this dream a reality and have become celebrities in their own right. There's Viagra, Vioxx, Celebrex, Claritin, Nexium, Prilosec, Lipitor, Rogaine, Zocor, Zoloft, Prozac, Paxil, and Lamisil, to name but a few. Some will be on patent for many more years to come, but others are soon scheduled to come off patent. Many patented drugs are simply me-too drugs designed to achieve the same effect as other patented drugs, but really add little value to society as a whole. To overcome lost revenues from patent expiries and the me-too drugs, each drug giant needs a certain number of new blockbuster drugs emerging from the R&D pipeline every year. Massive advertising campaigns are then designed to sell enough of the drug at a high enough price to recoup the R&D and advertising costs plus a target profit level. But the big pharmaceuticals, much to their dismay, are finding that the blockbuster drug cabinet is almost bare, even after throwing piles of dough into the R&D bucket. Despite the extensive range of the silliness of the illnesses for which blockbusters can be made to remedy, such as toenail fungus and hair shortfalls, Big Pharma is still finding that it can't find enough new drugs to bring to market. This makes them more desperate than ever to maintain high revenues on existing patented products, so they pour more and more funds into advertising and into fighting the generic companies in court. The end result is this. Profits are starting to come down in the pharmaceutical industry, and the near future looks glum. And we get to see even more drug advertising. Now, add to all of this the following pressures on the drug giants. First, European governments dare to regulate the prices of their precious blockbusters. Second, US state governments are now cracking down on some of Big Pharma's desperate practices to shut out the generic companies. Third, drug companies get pressure from managed care companies to lower drug prices. And fourth, drug companies now face a whole new set of giants, a coalition of corporate giants called Business for Affordable Medicine, whose healthcare expenses have been shooting up with the cost of prescription drugs. This coalition includes such behemoths as General Motors and Walmart. With all this opposition to the pharmaceutical sector, it looks like the drug companies, poor things, could use a dose of their own antidepressants. True to form, however, the pharmaceutical industry is not one to take all this lying down. It's fighting back on all fronts in a series of vicious attacks coupled with consumer manipulation that so characterize a desperate industry. But before we study this counter-attack strategy of Big Pharma, let's get to know the industry a little better and the regulation that defines its operating parameters with a little bit of US drug history. Miracle drugs and pervasive drug advertising have been a staple of the American diet for both the body and the mind for over 100 years.
Every one of you undoubtedly have a headache or pain remedy that you swear by. But haven't you noticed that on some occasions it fails you, that there are times it does not seem to work? On these occasions, let me suggest that you try Anacin, for here is a remedy that I'm sure won't fail you. You'll find the fastest and most complete relief in Anacin you've ever experienced. The reason is simple. Anacin contains not one pain-soothing agent alone, but four. One of which is in all probability the remedy you now customarily take to relieve pain. You can get Anacin at your druggist for a few cents. Your money back, if you're not pleased.
After more than 30 years of pressure for food and drug safety laws, the year 1906 finally ushered in the landmark Pure Food and Drug Act, amid shocking disclosures of the use of poisonous food additives and cure-all claims for worthless and dangerous patent medicines. In 1927, the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, was formed as the regulatory arm of the government charged with enforcing food and drug law. The pharmaceuticals later lost their battle against the strengthening of drug regulation in 1937 after a drug known as the elixir of sulfanilamide killed over 100 people, including many children. This paved the way for the passage of the 1938 Food, Drug and Cosmetic Act, which, among other things, required new drugs to be shown safe before they could be marketed. Then the thalidomide scare of the early 1960s put pressure on Congress to further strengthen drug regulation. But still, the brand name companies continued to prosper because they could set whatever price they wanted on their patented drugs. The year was 1984 when pharmaceutical companies first started seeing those shark fins emerge on the horizon. with the passage of the landmark Hatch-Waxman Act. Prior to this act, generic drug companies had to perform the same rigorous testing on generic drugs that the companies with the initial patent had to perform before they could be approved by the FDA. This made competition from generics virtually a non-issue because the investment required to get regulatory approval could only reasonably be recovered where the producer could charge a sufficiently high price for the drug once it was approved. In practice, this meant that the pre-Hatch-Waxman regulatory structure was heavily biased in favor of the companies with the drug patents, that is, the brand name drug companies. The 1984 Drug Price Competition and Patent Term Restoration Act, often referred to as the Hatch-Waxman Act after its authors Orrin Hatch and Harvey Waxman, changed the drug competition landscape drastically by lowering the regulatory hurdles for generic companies. This act said that, rather than generic companies performing all the safety tests that the original company with the patent carried out, they just had to show that the generic drug was chemically the same as the original drug, which had already been tested. Now, finally, there was a feasible economic model for the generic drug industry, because their initial costs to get the drug to market were now much lower. Well, that part of the 1984 law sounds pretty good for the consumer. But let's be realistic. Do you really expect the government to turn its back so abruptly on its buddies in the pharmaceutical sector just to create a deal for the consumer? It is one of the oldest tricks in the regulatory book to create a law that looks pretty damn good to the general public, but with some backdoor gifts to friendly private interests that are not obvious to the general public until many years later. The Trojan horse allowed into the 1984 regulatory regime contained an army of methods for the brand name companies to fight the generics, including 1. Extension of patent protection to make up for time lost in the FDA regulatory approval process, hence the term patent restoration in the name of the act. 2. The brand name companies also had the ability to get multiple patents on drugs covering not only the chemical itself, but also all kinds of preparation methods and techniques, making it much harder for the generics to prove that they had the same drug. These patents on methods and techniques could be staggered, such that when a patent on the main chemical expired, the patents on these various methods and techniques would still be in force. And third, the brand name companies were given a wide-ranging ability to challenge generic companies in the courts for patent infringement. All these backdoor methods available to keep patents going form a major arm of the strategy used by the brand name companies to ward off the threat from generic competition. And it is these very loopholes in the Hatch-Waxman Act that coalitions such as Business for Affordable Medicine and many congressional representatives are trying to close. In later years, the arsenal of the brand name companies was to be extended by the formation of the World Trade Organization and associated revisions to international trade law that further strengthened patent protection of pharmaceuticals, including the extension of the period of patent protection. Then, starting in about 1994, the brand name companies launched into a shameless, near-exponential growth in direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs for reasons that probably have a lot to do with increasing pressure from both generic competition and the managed care companies. This strategy of direct-to-consumer advertising proved critical for the brand name companies in their battle against shark fin curve created by generic competition. And nowadays, barely an hour can go by on the TV without us hearing from our friends in Big Pharma. And meanwhile, in other industrialized nations, the provision of universal health care means that drug prices are largely controlled and regulated by governments. Drug companies have not been allowed such freedom in other countries to either set prices for patented drugs or to advertise directly to the consumer. Consequently, the US consumer ends up not only paying for the privilege of being propagandized by the drug companies at home, they also subsidize lower drug costs abroad, where prices are regulated by overseas governments. Put all these factors together, and there's little mystery as to why prescription drug costs are spiraling out of control in this country, increasing at about 15% to 20% a year.
I think we may have another shot problem. Are you serious?
In order to understand where some of the most unsavory behaviors of the branded drug companies come from, it is instructive to look at several case studies. We will look at two of the most frequently referenced case studies in discussions of bizarre drug company behavior, whose stories can never be told enough. Case study number one is the blockbuster drug Nexium by AstraZeneca. This story was documented in the Wall Street Journal, June 6, 2002. Thanks to their bad eating habits, Americans are notorious for stomach-related problems, and this has proved to be a goldmine for the drug industry.
Today's fast, nerve-wracking pace is making millions suffer from the discomforts of gastric hyperacidity. Eating on the run, working under pressure, nervous tension, and smoking more than you should all help cause the trouble many know as American stomach. When this happens to you, when you're distressed by such symptoms as heartburn, acid indigestion, or a feeling of fullness, take Bicidol mint-flavored tablets. Bicidol mint-flavored tablets are not a makeshift, not a cure-all. They're specifically designed to do one job, and to do it quickly and well. And that job is to bring you prompt, pleasant relief of American stomach. Bicidol mint-flavored tablets help neutralize the excess acids that cause this discomfort. They soothe irritated membranes while gently helping to restore normal balance. So next time you're upset and distressed due to acid indigestion, remember to take Bicidol mint-flavored tablets, that's all. You'll like their refreshing mint flavor, and they're so handy to carry.
Stomach ulcer and heartburn drugs like Prilosec and Zantac before it were the largest selling blockbusters of their time. In 1995, AstraZeneca launched what was known as Project Sharkfin to draw up a battle plan as its $6 billion a year heartburn drug Prilosec was going to lose its patent by April of 2001. After years of work, the Sharkfin team came up with the rather unimaginative solution of launching a successor drug that was basically the same as Prilosec, but would be under patent when Prilosec lost its patent. AstraZeneca also used every loophole available in the Hatch-Waxman Act to construct a legal minefield for would-be copycats in order to extend the Prilosec patent for as long as possible and give AstraZeneca more time to convert Prilosec users over to the patented Nexium. The related legal battles over the Prilosec patents continue to this day and are closely watched by those that follow drug prices. To convert post-patent Prilosec users to its patented sibling Nexium, AstraZeneca spends about $500 million a year in advertising of this single drug, making it now the most advertised drug in the United States, taking over from Prilosec a few years ago. So far, that's paid off handsomely, as 60% of those switching from Prilosec are going over to Nexium.
time every minute.
And every woman who ever suffered from frequent, persistent heartburn.
If you've treated your heartburn and changed your diet, but the pain comes back two or more days a week, then you may think you know about acid reflux disease.
But there's something about acid reflux that I didn't know.
Over time, that acid churning up can wear away the lightning in your esophagus.
I didn't know.
Now the makers of Prilosec introduced their new purple pill, Nexium. Just one prescription Nexium a day gives many people complete resolution of heartburn symptoms.
That could mean complete heartburn relief.
And Nexium is also proven to heal erosions in the esophagus caused by acid reflux.
Relieve the heartburn, feel the damage. It's possible with the new purple pill called Nexium.
Nexium is one half of the Prilosec molecule, and it works pretty much the same, but it is just chemically different enough to win a patent of its own. The marketing spin that Nexium is better at dealing with eroded esophagus is good for converting Prilosec users that watch primetime TV over to Nexium, but, according to the Wall Street Journal article, is built on very shaky scientific foundations. According to this article, four studies were commissioned to see if Nexium was better at healing eroded esophagus than Prilosec. Two studies found that Nexium wasn't any better at all, and the other two found it was better only by a smidgen. Based on this piddling bit of evidence, we all get to hear about eroded esophagi and purple pills with racing stripes on a daily basis. Such tactics form a common strategy for maintaining revenue as drugs come off patent. A very similar strategy is being employed by Schering Plough to convert users of the allergy drug Claritin, which is coming off patent, to the new patented Clarinex, which is almost exactly the same. Case study 2 is the blockbuster drug Taxol by Bristol Myers Squibb, as documented in the Wall Street Journal, June 5 of 2002. Bristol Myers Squibb is currently being sued by 29 states for illegally delaying generic competition of its blockbuster cancer drug, Taxol, and costing governments and consumers billions of dollars, as well as costing lives. The basis of the suit is the claim that Bristol Myers Squibb misled the US Patent Office to delay generic competition on Taxol. But it gets more offensive than this. You see, Taxol is derived from the bark of the Pacific yew tree, and its pharmaceutical benefits were discovered not by Bristol Myers Squibb, but by the taxpayer-funded National Institutes of Health. The NIH handed Taxol over to Bristol Myers in 1991 as a big gift. In return, Bristol Myers, who charges a hefty price for Taxol, has acted like a badly spoiled child, not wanting to share this gift with anyone, even 10 years later. Bristol Myers Squibb, similar to what AstraZeneca did in setting up its legal minefield around Prilosec, has used the tactic of staggered patents of every technique and methodology used to serve up Taxol to maintain its monopoly on the taxpayers' gift to them. This is such a common strategy of counterattack by the brand name companies against the generics that state governments, consumers, companies, and health insurers that end up footing the bill for prescription drugs are themselves challenging it at every turn. Poor Bristol Myers Squibb. In addition to these lawsuits and angry governments, the planned heir to the cancer drug throne, a drug known as Erbitrix, developed in a joint venture with ImClone Systems, was rejected by the FDA and wound up in a sordid scandal with the queen of good cooking, Martha Stewart. And what are they going to do with the shark fin now?
Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities are Mother Nature's recipes that bring the bare necessities of life.
These case studies were selected to give an idea of the desperate tactics used by the drug industry to boost sales revenues and profits in the face of generic competition. But of course, the tactics don't stop there. Following is a small sampling of other techniques employed to keep sales revenues and drug prices high. First, drug companies spend most of their direct marketing budgets, about 85% of them, or $14 billion a year, marketing directly to the medical profession. This consists mostly of giving doctors buckets full of free samples, about $8 billion worth in 2000, noting that patients who start on free samples of pills often convert to paying customers. Then, of course, there's all the dinners, sports tickets, and many other types of gifts to the medical profession. Second, drug companies have now started target marketing to consumers directly through pharmacies through what looks like an informational booklet provided by the trusted pharmacy, but is really an ad sponsored by a branded drug company. And now, believe it or not, those same advertising agencies that bring us the subliminal messages of eroded esophagi using big canyons are entering the business of performing clinical trials for their clients, the drug companies. This should lower both advertising costs and expenses of clinical trials, for there is every incentive for the advertising agency to find that their tested drug is just fantastic. After all, they will have an exclusive on the advertising account once the drug is launched. As noted, these case studies and other techniques are just a small sampling of the techniques the branded drug companies use to stay alive and profitable in the face of generic competition, decreased innovation, and increasing opposition from many quarters. There are many more strategies employed, and if you read the business press, you can probably read about a new one just about every day. Indeed, it is remarkable that the granting of 20-year monopolies and the gifts of publicly funded research can't even help this industry solve its emerging profitability problems, let alone that the industry increasingly fails to provide value-added service to the public. Surely it is time to rethink the viability and sustainability of the branded drug sector in its current form, and in particular, the wisdom of the patented medicine model in the modern world. The following seemingly prophetic quote from an 1851 edition of the magazine The Economist describes perfectly the degenerative phase the patented medicine model has reached by the start of the 21st century. Quote, "The public will learn that patents are artificial stimuli to improvident exertions, that they cheat people by promising what they cannot perform, that they rarely give security to really good inventions, and elevate into importance a number of trifles. No possible good can ever come of a patent law, however admirably it may be framed." End quote. This 1851 quote gives a good description of what has become of today's pharmaceutical sector when viewed from a global perspective. Patents have certainly provided what the article describes as artificial stimuli to improvident exertions, or, put another way, wasteful spending. And there is no question that we have seen the elevation into importance a number of trifles, namely the blockbuster lifestyle drugs such as Viagra, Rogaine, and various antidepressants, as well as unnecessary drugs that are virtually the same as a host of other drugs already on the market. And all this takes place against the backdrop of a developing world HIV/AIDS crisis that has resulted in up to 40% of the population being infected in some African countries, and is now starting its exponential growth throughout Eastern Europe, the former Soviet states, China, and the rest of Southeast Asia. To date, the West has remained largely unconcerned with the HIV/AIDS crisis in Africa. There have been some nice efforts, of course, from various quarters, but so far the response has been woefully inadequate from those that can most afford to help. To put it bluntly, this is because the self-interest component that drives the capital markets just is not there. Africa is only a minor trading partner with the West, and the West has relatively little economic interest in Africa. So far, all the help adds up to not enough, and the disease continues to outpace efforts to stop it. Out of a $10 billion a year request from the UN, the West can only bear to part with $2 billion to assist in dealing with the problem of HIV/AIDS in the developing world. And compared to other drug investment, relatively little goes into finding a vaccine. If and when a vaccine is available, distribution of it will pose the next major hurdle. And now there are increasing reports detailing the spread of HIV/AIDS throughout the former or semi-communist, now market-directed nuclear power giants, Russia and China. A startling report from UNAIDS, released in June of 2002, entitled HIV/AIDS and subtitled China's Titanic Peril, reveals the state of the problem of HIV/AIDS in China. With 1 to 2 million people infected today, infection rates have been increasing at more than 50% a year. Estimates of the number of people infected by 2010 range between 10 and 20 million. The former Soviet states have seen a five-fold increase in infections in just the past 3 years, and they have the fastest spreading epidemic of all, according to a September 2002 UN report. A survey from British scientists released in June predicts that within 5 years, one in every 20 Russian adults will be infected with HIV/AIDS. Both China and Russia are rapidly developing market economies. One is a major trading partner of the United States, the other is set to become one of the European Union. Unless you think this development will help, think about the African nation of Botswana. Botswana was the golden child of economic development of sub-Saharan Africa, financed largely by its mining industry after it gained independence. Its first AIDS case was detected in 1985, and then HIV/AIDS built slowly for several years after that. But by the 1990s, it was spreading furiously throughout the general population, so that by 2002, it affects almost 40% of the entire population. And why is this so much worse than the less developed sub-Saharan region, you might be wondering? It's largely because of the rapid economic development itself, many people think. The road networks that come with development, the mobility of labour away from home and families that comes with globalisation, and men leaving their wives to get work all sped up the spread of HIV/AIDS. Today, many people in Africa think that China and Russia look a bit like their countries did 5 to 10 years ago. But there's more. With the Western-style development going on in China and Russia, comes rapid growth in drug use, teenage sex, commercial sex, and poverty. These increases are being observed across China, Eastern Europe, and Russia, and the relevant populations are showing huge increases in infection. In addition, the old social safety nets and healthcare systems have largely collapsed. To make matters worse, in rural China, the poverty of farmers forced them to sell their blood for trade on the lucrative national and international plasma markets. Millions of rural people participated in what is known as plasmapheresis programs in return for cash payments to supplement their ever-dwindling incomes. In this process, their blood is taken, it is then pooled with lots of other people, and the plasma is separated from the red blood cells of the pooled blood. The plasma is then siphoned off and sold on the international plasma markets, and the now pooled red blood cells are reinfused back into the pool of donors so that those donors can keep giving blood at a high frequency. In such a process, all it takes is for one person in a pool of, say, 100 to have HIV, and all 100 will get infected. This process has greatly increased China's HIV/AIDS problem. And add this to the fact that the population pressures and the preference for male children has created a dangerously high and unnatural male-to-female ratio, plus the big taboo on discussion about sex in Eastern cultures, and you see a growing number of catalysts for disease spread. Economically, China is currently the fourth largest trading partner of the United States, and is very likely to become the number two or three before too long, and has a strong chance of becoming number one. With China joining the World Trade Organization, there's tons of capital wanting to invest in China. As residents and consumers in the United States, our lives are undeniably intertwined with those of the Chinese. So much of our own purchasing power, and hence quality of life, is a direct result of the relatively low cost of labor in China. And as our population ages, more and more of the productive labor force we depend on will actually be in countries like China. Nobody can deny that the economic interests of the US are very much tied up with the well-being of the labor force of China. If the United States does for China's emerging HIV/AIDS epidemic what it did for Africa, which was not very much, the consequences on the US economy could be quite severe. Maybe this self-interest component is the only thing that can get the US to do what it can well afford to do about this crisis in the developing world. Then, I'm quite sure a vaccine could be found and distributed in no time at all. Similar arguments apply to the relationship between Western and Eastern Europe. The European Union has an added incentive. Since this is all happening right next door, the epidemic may very well stretch into Western Europe if Western Europe doesn't help do something about it in a hurry. There appears to be little point in asking the branded drug industry for too much help on such important matters. They simply won't budge without a monopoly and a profit stream, neither of which is a suitable incentive model for this global crisis. It is heartbreaking to see the present $8 billion shortfall in the United Nations request for HIV/AIDS assistance compared to the many tens of billions spent by the pharmaceutical giants on advertising nonsense pills to us daily, suing the generics at every turn, and developing medicines that aren't really necessary. And it is we who end up footing the bill for all this, whether it's in the form of our own taxes, in the form of higher health premiums, or in the form of direct prescription purchases. If global capitalism would like to save itself from its own worst enemy, which is, of course, itself, it better act quick smart. Following is a prescription for the capitalists to save their global markets. Step one is to fire the branded drug industry, and the rationale runs as follows. Since the branded drug industry is wasting lots of our time and money and yet not helping to solve the really big and important health problems, we can conclude that they are a big inefficient sector of the markets due to too many years of monopolies and taxpayer-funded gifts. Though we really do appreciate many of their efforts over the past century, from which we have all benefited, their usefulness has now expired and they are fired. And that should make the markets more efficient. We'll certainly keep the generic companies, though, and redirect R&D monies into the public sector. Step number two will be to expand generic production in a patent-free environment. The generics can keep producing all existing FDA-approved drugs in a patent-free environment. This should lower our total annual drug costs by about $80 billion a year. Step number three will be to put some of these savings towards some much-needed public benefits. We can use about $15 billion of the $80 billion savings from retiring the brand name companies for a prescription drug benefit for seniors, whose costs are now much lower because all drugs are generics. And then we'll also put some $15 billion towards insuring the uninsured. Now we have still about $50 billion left. Step number four will be to redirect R&D funds into research prioritized on a needs basis. We'll set aside $30 billion for drug research and development in the public sector to replace what the private sector used to do, except with a more needs-oriented approach. All the scientists, researchers, and administrative workers from the now extinct brand name companies will get new jobs at the new publicly funded research centres. Realising that the biggest needs are in the developing world and that our own economy is intimately tied to their well-being in this globalised world, we set the first $15 billion aside exclusively for HIV/AIDS vaccines and treatments. The next $5 billion will go on tropical diseases, tuberculosis and so forth, and then the other $10 billion can go into the most important things at home. We still have $20 billion left of our savings from firing the branded drug companies. Step number five will be to give the sales and marketing people something useful to do. Of the people that used to work for the branded drug companies, we still have the sales and marketing people and the lawyers sitting around idle, which is quite worrisome. And since the sales and marketing people are always telling us that they are not really annoying and that they are instead providing the social service of distributing important information, we have the perfect job for them. First, we will need to put them in decompression chambers, and then some training will take place to retool them for a more wholesome career. They will each be provided with 10,000 packets of condoms and sent all over the world, from India to the Congo to Russia to China to Brazil. Their job will be to sell the use and advantages of condoms and safe sex to as many people in the world as possible. This should be right up their alley. For years they have been walking into clinics and doctors' offices with free samples to give away and stories to tell. They will get compensated based on the preventative practices adopted in their region. The total cost of the global prevention plan will be about $10 billion. Now the lawyers that used to work for the branded drug companies suing the generics will actually be left on their own, because they are inventive enough to find other ways to occupy their time. But we still have $10 billion left, and there's a lot that can be done with this remaining money, and I'll just leave that up to your imagination. That's all for the Wizards of Money Part 16. Please note that the Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org where you can get the text of all episodes and you can get all further references underlying the information in each episode.
Look for the bare necessities.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.